KORC is looking for volunteer local reporters to tell the stories that aren't getting told. So if you have something to share, an expert opinion, or even just anything cool you think people should know about, write us at info@korcfm.com and let's talk. And join us on Sundays to hear local news, interviews, and stories that aren't getting told anywhere else.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City Meetings for the week of February 19th, 2024. On Tuesday, February 27th at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board CAB meeting will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, February 28th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. On Thursday, February 28th at 1 p.m., there will be a Business Reliance Workshop held in person at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. Find out what types of incidents business owners need to prepare for and how local government coordinates response and recovery efforts during and after a disaster. On Friday, March 1st at 4 p.m., the City Legislative Committee will be meeting online only. Since the link to join the meeting is long and difficult to say on air, we've abbreviated it to clc.korcfm.com. And finally, on Saturday, March 1st at 10 a.m. to noon, Corvallis City Councilor for Ward 5, Charlene Ellis, will be holding Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library. Feel free to stop by and say hello and ask questions about local government. 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue here in Corvallis. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
Thanks for joining us this week on KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 here on KORC 105.9 LPFM. We are streaming worldwide at korcfm.com. This is Dan Kroll in the Southtown studio. Glad you could join us this afternoon. Last night was our fundraiser concert that we held at the Old World Deli. A number of our volunteers showed up, and it's a kind of a low energy day. And this week we've been doing a lot of preparation for getting our fundraiser together. And luckily we have some stories from past weeks that we can share with you today, and they're still relevant. In fact, we'll go ahead and kick off the hour with a report that you may have heard last week put together by Explorin' Lauren regarding light pollution, a problem that is very present that a lot of us may not even think about. And then after that feature, we are going to hear an interview with Jackie Naiman Jones. You may recognize that name from the B-horror film Manos, The Hands of Fate. And if you have not seen Manos, The Hands of Fate, you can find it online. And it's a movie that was made in El Paso, Texas, back in the 1960s. Jackie Naiman Jones was the little girl, Debbie, in the film. And she has done a lot throughout her life to keep the legacy of that film alive. If you actually look her up on Facebook, Jackie Naiman Jones, that's N-E-Y-M-A-N, she has written books about the experience. She does artwork. She has done a lot of work with her local school board up in Falls City, and I'm going to be interviewing her in just a few minutes here on KORC News, Music, and Civics. If you would like to be on this program as a news reporter, perhaps an interviewer, maybe you'd like to talk about topics that are on your mind, you are welcome to get in touch with us at info@korcfm.com, and we will talk. Here's Explorin' Lauren. Thanks for joining us this week on KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll.
This is a KORC Community Voices installment. Have you noticed that the world looks a little different lately? Especially on our roads, and especially at night. You might be driving, or just a passenger, or even a pedestrian on the road, and you notice a bright light ahead. What could that be? It must still be a half mile away. As it gets closer, your eyes start to strain, hurting and squinting until you can't see anything at all. It's a struggle just to look straight ahead, even after they've passed you. How did it become this painful just to travel after dark? And how can this go on when we all have to use the roads? It's clear by this point that some portion of our population is affected this way by some modern lighting, particularly in car headlights and public street lamps. In the past 30 years, a revolution in lighting technology has taken place, with the advent of LED lighting, that is, the light-emitting diode. And among the many uses for LEDs, you've probably noticed the change in car headlights and public street lighting. There are many advantages to the more energy-efficient, more compact LED units that have replaced incandescent and fluorescent bulbs. But the biological and physical safety hazards for humans and wildlife need to be considered with this world-changing technology. These two particular applications of lighting, car headlights and street lamps, have tended to use very high color temperatures, resulting in a blue or white hue, as well as extreme brightness to simulate daylight at night. Some portion of consumers demand this for perceived safety or clout, while many others seem dangerously affected by the glare of oncoming traffic or public lighting. Indeed, on a rainy night, the combination of traffic and public lighting reflected on a wet road can result in overstimulation, rendering pedestrians the least visible thing on the road. Data compiled in New York from 2018 to 2023 showed a 28% increase in crashes linked to headlight glare, and more data are following this trend. The human biological system is intricately linked to light wavelengths, which guide our circadian rhythms, or biological clock, to coordinate the essential processes that keep us alive and healthy at the cellular scale. As we're bombarded by bright artificial light at night, more and more scientific research has linked artificial light to a cascade of adverse health problems in many organ systems, from cognitive decline to obesity to cardiovascular disease and beyond. Much research already exists addressing the harmful effects of artificial light on complex nocturnal ecosystems, particularly on disrupting the life cycles of many nocturnal insects and bird species, both of which have experienced precipitous population declines in recent decades. You may have noticed people complaining about these things of late, about the intense glare and the white or blue color temperature these lights use. And that's because the industries and agencies that could be regulating the manufacture of lighting technology for safety and environmental hazards have not adequately done so. While the Code of Federal Regulations does technically limit headlight brightness to 3,000 lumens, about twice what incandescent and halogen bulbs typically produce, that clearly isn't being enforced, and there are other aspects to the technology that cause problems such as the light density and color temperature. Most state DMVs do not even inspect for brightness or the aim of headlights. Motivated by perceived cost savings, many cities across the United States, including Corvallis, have franchise agreements with utility corporations that have years' worth of glaring white street lamps already stockpiled, giving residents and even city government little agency in protecting the night. Paradoxically, some cities have actually increased their energy usage after vastly expanding their public lighting infrastructure. By the way, you can request from the city of Corvallis that shielding be installed on your street lamps to limit the light cast downwards in a radius around the lamp, rather than outward into your eyes or bedroom window. So much stationary light pollution could be blocked by simply installing these shields, such as the egregious glow emitted from the Oregon State University campus, which has the opportunity to be a proactive pioneer in mitigating lighting hazards without compromising student safety at all. What this all means is that, for now, it's up to us, the consumers, to spread awareness and know-how to protect each other on our roads. Check the brightness of your outdoor lighting as it's visible from the road, and install new bulbs or shielding if necessary. Stand in front of your own vehicle to check for brightness, swap out the bulbs if you're able, or have a mechanic or dealership swap them. And spread the positive message about being part of the solution. The Soft Lights Foundation is a national advocacy group headed by Mark Baker, who's attempting to sue the FDA for failing to fulfill its congressional mandate to regulate radiation from electronic products. This is after years of petitions to the National Highway and Transportation Safety Administration and the Department of Energy, with tens of thousands of reports of personal harm from lighting hazards, requesting formal inquiries into this glaring problem. The road is a commons that we must learn to share, and sensible applications of lighting will benefit us all without compromising our safety. While we can protect ourselves and each other from this systemic problem to some extent, it's important to remember that this artificial lighting crisis is a solvable one. Continuing to contact your city council and state legislators will raise awareness about the hazards of modern lighting and their sensible solutions. And someday, we'll again find a place in our world for the dark and tranquil night.
Thanks to Explorin' Lauren for producing that piece on light pollution. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. and every Monday from 5 to 6 p.m. Up next, it's an interview that I did with Jackie Naiman Jones. This is Dan Kroll in the Southtown studio. Jackie Naiman Jones is an actress, producer, artist who lives up in Falls City, and many of you may know her work in Manos, The Hands of Fate, a 1960s film that is known for being one of the worst films ever made, according to some. And here's my interview that was made just about a year ago up in Falls City. Thanks for joining us this afternoon on KORC News, Music, and Civics. And if you miss any or all of this program, you can catch it online at our website, korcfm.com.
I could have sworn we didn't make a wrong turn.
You must have. Where did the road go?
No need to get upset. We'll find it.
You know, we should have asked for better directions at the last gas station.
Now look, the sign pointed this way.
Mike, let's go back to the crossroads and ask those kids we saw.
Okay, okay, but I know we can't be wrong. Look, the sign pointed this way.
Where did this place come from? It wasn't here a few minutes ago.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
We only want to know where Valley Lodge is.
Which way do we go?
There is no way out of here. It will be dark soon. There is no way out of here.
No way out?
Well, you know, we could spend the night here, and then
oh,
tomorrow
Mike,
we could...
Mike, I don't want to spend the night here. I don't like the looks of the place.
Well, it seems we have no alternative. Well, how about it, Torgo? Can we spend the night here?
I'll get the luggage.
I'll be glad to leave. I've had all of this place I want.
Madam, it will be very dangerous to leave now. The master wants you.
Wants me? What kind of talk is that?
He wants you for his wife.
Arise, my wives, and hear the will of Manus.
Oh, my God!
Manus, god of primal darkness, as thou hast decreed, so have I done. The hands of fate have doomed this man. Thy will is done. Manus will be served.
It's a dreary, overcast, early spring afternoon in Falls City, Oregon. This is Dan Krall from KORC, and I am hanging out in Falls City with a resident of 23 years, Jackie Naaman Jones. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Now, some of you might recognize that name if you are at all a fan of horror films, whether serious or B-rated films, perhaps even what has become known to be the worst film ever made, Manos, The Hands of Fate. This is a film from 1966 and is available online. There are several versions in circulation, including a remastered version, which arguably does not capture the original aesthetic of Manos, The Hands of Fate, a color film from the mid-1960s that was made by a troupe of aspiring filmmakers in El Paso, Texas. And Jackie Naaman Jones played the part of Debbie, the child in the film.
Yes. Yes, and this is my actual voice because the film was dubbed, and my six-year-old voice was dubbed by a middle-aged woman.
I was going to ask that. I could tell it had been redubbed because a lot of the ambient sound and all that was lost. Did they do that because the sound on set just didn't work out, or did they not have microphones plugged into the cameras?
Well, it's 1966, and they had to rent the equipment and buy the film, and all that was really available in El Paso at that time was what they got was a Filmo 70, which was a camera that was used in Korea and Vietnam War for film footage, and it was a wind-up camera. It shot 32 seconds and shot silent.
I did notice a lot of bugs in the film flying in the foreground and background. Was this shot in the summertime?
Yeah, it was actually shot. You have to admire these people because they shot the entire film in like 8 days of nights and weekends because everybody had full-time jobs. So that explains some of the day-for-night shots. And then when they did shoot at night, yeah, it was the summertime because I was out of school, so it was like July. It was the summer I turned 7. I was 6 years old. I turned 7. So, yes, there was many moths. And as far as lighting goes, the lighting was generally car headlights or the usher's flashlights from our local community theater.
And if you could summarize what the film is about for those who may have not seen it, what is Manos, The Hands of Fate, about?
Well, it's a ill-fated trip of a family of three, a mother, father, a child, and an unruly little poodle dog named Peppy. And they're on a road trip, a family trip, and they get lost. They turn down the wrong road to what says the Valley Lodge. So they think they're going to a little hotel. And it just doesn't turn out that way. It's kind of run by this polygamist cult leader and his sidekick, Torgo, who, you know, it's still disputed whether he just has misshapen legs or if he's truly meant to be a satyr.
I'll be glad to leave. I've had all of this place I want.
Madam, it will be very dangerous to leave now. The master wants you.
Wants me? What kind of talk is that?
He wants you for his wife. He loves beautiful women.
Don't you ever try that again, you beast!
The master wants you, but he can't have you. I want you.
Stop that talk this instant, you hear?
He wants you, but he can't have you.
On a side note, my dad made most of the props of the film, all the artwork, the sculptures. My mother did most of the costumes, but Torgo's costume in particular was actually the coveralls were my dad's welding coveralls. That was his desert scavenging hat, and he made Torgo's staff, but the legs were just baling wire, like fencing wire rolled up to fit, and then some car foam inside to cushion his legs. So that's what kept his legs in that shape. There's rumors that John Reynolds became addicted to painkillers and committed suicide because of the pain of his costume, but I think that's highly unlikely to happen in a space of 8 days.
Did he wear that costume for the entirety of 8 days?
No, he didn't.
I'm sure he got a chance to take breaks. And
yes.
And we should note that your dad, you mentioned he did all this other stuff with the film, but he is also the master.
Oh, yes. He's the master. And that demon dog, the Doberman, was our family pet, Shanka.
Shanka. So it is true that the portrait, the notable portrait of the master with his dog, it in real life was a man and his own dog.
Yes, it was. Yeah, and my mom made the master's robe.
And you currently have a dog named Shanka, is that correct?
Yeah, she kind of has some of the markings of the Doberman, and she thinks she's a big dog, but she's a 7-pound Chiweenie.
And this is Shanka the Third?
Shanka the Third, yes. Oh, and Shanka is my family on my dad's side. We're of Osage descent from Oklahoma. And Shanka in the Osage language literally means dog.
Last night, the KORC DJs and myself were gathered at my place, the Southtown Studio, and we watched the film. It was the second or actually the third time I had seen it because I had seen a remastered version, which arguably it loses a lot of the aesthetic of the version that I have on DVD. And I was curious a few times throughout the film. I wanted to ask you, do you remember much about being on set, how those days played out? Do you remember it very clearly?
Well, I did. I remembered it. Quite a lot of it. And the reason is because after the premiere, it was pretty much people were laughing. And it was not a good experience, the premiere on November 15th, 1966. And so the theater canceled the rest of the run. So it was only shown once and then it disappeared. And, you know, it's kind of been said, it's like the cast and crew snuck out of the theater and then split up and never talked about it again, like they'd pulled off some kind of heist or something. So nobody really talked about it. But to me, as a child and adoring my dad, it was the best summer of my life. So I held on to those memories really tight.
And then the premiere happened how much longer after the film was made that summer?
Well, so the film was made like in July and the premiere was in November. So it happened very, very quickly, as you can tell.
Do you feel like if the public had not been so non-receptive, if maybe they had a sense of humor or sense of irony, that maybe Manos would have had a different fate, as it were, throughout the years? Maybe you all wouldn't have split up and gone your separate ways?
No, not really. I mean, it was an embarrassment, and people were laughing, so it kind of was a comedy from the very beginning, unintentionally.
So the filmmakers never intended this to be a comedy?
Oh, no, not at all. But my dad was highly respected. He actually, in 1966, that year, he always played the lead role. I mean, he had played R.P. McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was Gordon Lowther.
Are you talking about a theatrical production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Okay.
And in The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, so in 1966, he played the role of King Henry IV in Henry IV, the play. And that's where Hal Warren found everybody, because John Reynolds, who played Torgo, was in that play. Hal Warren, who created the film, was in that play. He'd already written the script, but he looked around and he saw all the male actors he wanted, even the crew members, the camera guy, Bob Guidry, and Bernie Rosenblum were part of that film. So all the men came from that play. But my dad won Best Actor of the Year award, which I have in my studio. I didn't get a chance to show you, but I will, for 1966. And he was so well respected in the community. El Paso has a very, and still does, a very strong artistic community. And my dad was very well respected. So the writers, the entertainment writers, were very kind to pretty much not write anything about it. They allowed it to just lie. I do have an article, though, called Hero is Massaged to Death in Local Film, meaning Torgo, because, you know, he was massaged to death almost. Yeah.
Yes. So your dad and a lot of these actors came from the El Paso theater scene?
All the men did. The women came from the local modeling school, Mannequin Manor. It was a finishing school to teach young ladies how to sit properly and serve tea and, you know, things that women are supposed to do.
Is that why they were so properly behaved in the film?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, when my mom made the costumes, she made their costumes as well. And I remember the original costumes. I specifically remember my parents laying the fabric out on the floor of the living room to create my dad's costume, the master's robe. But I remember her making the dresses, and the women revolted. And so my mom added that extra red strip. It was just an kind of an impromptu thing, cut a red piece of fabric to go between their legs. So, but their other revolt was they showed up on set in the largest granny panties and bras they could find. but yes, that's why they were, that's why all their movements look like they're walking down a runway.
There was something kind of John Waters-ish about their behavior as well, I must say.
It was pretty funny. And here's a good, interesting aside, is that several years later, when I was 12, my mother enrolled me in Mannequin Manor Modeling School and for the summer classes. And she would drop me off in front in the morning to pick me up several hours later. And as soon as she was out of sight, I'd just go and walk around downtown El Paso, and then I'd show up on time and just stand in front of the school with all the other girls who I'd never actually met and get in the car and go home.
Those were the days, huh?
Oh, yeah. That was early 70s. I would have been about 1972, different times.
So you were enrolled for just that one summer at the...
Yeah.
Does it still exist?
I doubt it. I seriously doubt it.
Probably not teaching the same values as it would have in the 70s if it still does exist.
No, I can't imagine, but you can look it up. Mannequin Manor Modeling School.
We're speaking with Jackie Naiman-Jones, who played the part of Debbie in Manos, The Hands of Fate, a horror film that has become a legend in its own right since its release in 1966. And you are a current resident of Falls City, Oregon. When Manos kind of came back to the public eye, as it were, was it thanks to the internet that Manos became famous again?
Well, that's a crazy thing. So let's see. Mystery Science Theater, they put it on in the middle of January, or I think it was like January 23rd, 1993. And my dad was living on the coast in Lincoln City, and I was living in Northern California. And my older son was like 3 years old. And my dad called me and he said, "You'll never believe what I just saw on television." He was taking a nap, you know, on a rainy January day in his easy chair. And he heard some strange music familiar, and he opened his eyes and there he was. And he was so shocked that he just watched it. And when it was over, he called me and said this. And he said it was on Comedy Central. And we had Comedy Central, and there was an 800 number in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen, as I recall. And I remember just being like, what? That can't be. So I turned on the TV, and I called that phone number. And I believe it was a Sunday. And can you imagine calling an 800 number today and getting a human that you could speak to, you know, on a Sunday? So this guy answers the phone, and he identified himself. He was in the Manhattan offices, HBO offices, he said. And I said, "You just showed a movie I've been looking for my whole life." I mean, this is 27 years later.
And you didn't have a copy of the film?
Nobody did. It just disappeared. It was gone. And also, Hal Warren had kept my dad's robe and the painting, the Master and Dog painting. And I don't know what happened to the staff. So I had nothing. I mean, I had no memories. I mean, I had nothing physical from the film, and neither did my dad. So this guy, I tell him, "I've been looking for this my whole life. Is there any way I can get a copy?" And he says, "Well, what's the name of it?" And I told him, "Manos, The Hands of Fate." And I'm shaking. And there's this long pause, and I didn't know if he'd hung up on me or if we got disconnected and I have to get the courage to call back. And he just goes, "Oh my God, are you Debbie?" That's how I found out that anybody in the world cared about it but me.
How do you think he guessed that you were Debbie? Of all people you could have been.
Well, he said, "I just had that on my desk, and that is our favorite bad movie here in the HBO offices." So he was quite familiar with it. And who else would call him up and said, "My whole family was part of this film, and I've been looking for it my whole life"? He figured it out immediately. So anyway, I gave him my address, and he sent me a copy, and I still have it. It's a VHS with a hand-titled sticker on it.
And that's what they used to show on Mystery Science Theater 3000?
Yes, it's why it looks like, you know, you're looking, watching it through a screen door, a copy of a copy of a copy, who knows, by the time they got to that. But, you know, since then, a young man who found the original work print that went through the camera in 1966 in an eBay auction, and he did a Kickstarter and raised, $48,000 in 2015. And he restored it, in true fashion, frame by frame by frame. I mean, he said it looked like, it had been taped in places with, scotch tape, and it was just filthy. And he did it professionally, and if you watch the restored version, it's a different film. I mean, you can see the mistakes so much more clearly, but it's not the same film. It's Frank and Trace from MST did it for their Christmas special 2 years ago and invited me as a special guest. And I got hold of Ben Solovey, who'd created the restoration, and he gave them permission to show that version. And halfway through, Frank actually goes, "Guy, I almost feel bad making fun of it now."
Did you give him permission to keep on making fun of it?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I mean, people tell me, you have such a good sense of humor about this and everything. And I embrace it. These are my people. I grew up on Firesign Theater. My best friend and I had every album memorized and drove people nuts, So I get that kind of humor. I say these are my people. It's my tribe. But besides that, if it hadn't been as bad as it is, and if it hadn't been in public domain, it never would have been rediscovered. I mean, how many films are just lost forever? How much art is gone forever? It's just, it's just a miracle, and I feel really blessed to be part of this. It's changed my life in so many ways. I mean, on a personal level, my dad and I, it gave a healing in our lives and our families. And, there's a lot of levels to this. It's a pretty deep rabbit hole.
Well, Torgo, in or out?
Patient, dear.
Very well. The master will be very disturbed.
I'll get the luggage.
Torgo, we'll stay tonight and then tomorrow.
You must be. You cannot stay. The master would not approve.
See, you're feeling better already. Look at this.
Mike,
we're speaking with Jackie Naiman-Jones, who played the part of Debbie in Manos, The Hands of Fate. And the fact that the film was lost, would I be correct in assuming that that really wasn't part of your childhood or teenage identity, to be like, oh yeah, I'm the child from Manos, The Hands of Fate, because it was kind of out of commission at the time, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I'd tell stories to friends here and there, but nobody was really interested,
If they hadn't seen it, what did they have to relate to?
Yeah, most of my friends weren't in theater. I mean, I grew up in El Paso, Texas, on the border. You could see the Rio Grande River from our front porch. And our house had been built during the Mexican Revolution, and they said that you could watch the battle going on from the front porch. It was an adobe house with foot-thick walls. But my dad was executive. His real job was he was executive director of the South El Paso Boys Club. And my mother was a teacher. And we lived in a neighborhood where we were the only non-Hispanic family. And so I was different from the beginning. Plus, my dad being the kind of artist he was, and, you know, an actor, and my family was different. My mother was a women's libber, and, you know, we were quite different, and so I was kind of a lonely kid. So it wasn't anything that I really talked about much. There was nobody that could relate.
We're speaking with Jackie Naiman-Jones, who played the part of Debbie in Manos, The Hands of Fate, a horror film that has become a legend in its own right since its release in 1966. And you are a current resident of Falls City, Oregon, where you have history of raising a family here, involvement on the school board, a brother-in-law who has been the mayor. What are you doing nowadays in 2023?
Gosh, I mean, I'm doing my art. I'm working, collaborating with other people to build an arts co-op that encompasses all the arts, you know, the healing arts like yoga, meditation, Reiki. I've developed classes on healing through color. I had a 30-year career doing high-end faux finish and you know, creating environments for people and businesses that really made them feel at peace and at home through the color and the finishes. And so it's something it's a gift. And so now I'm looking at collaborating with people here in Falls City to create some programs for people and for kids especially. We want to help empower the kids. They don't have a lot of opportunities out here, and I know a lot of very talented people, and watched, you know, my boys are adults now, and I watched them grow up with people that have become musicians and artists, and through without having a whole lot of support necessarily. So anyway, those are my goals, and selling my art. I do online classes. I've been teaching the paint and sip kind of parties for about 7 years, but I'm changing it up. I'm doing a lot of just a different direction of that. I'm doing painting on wine glasses and bottle painting with the fairy light strings and everything. I've always been one. It's time to move ahead of the pack. You know, there's so much going on and people want to do these events, but I need to do something different than what everybody else is doing right now.
And the medium that you primarily work with is paint.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my personal artwork is very much inspired by my dad. We used to go out in the desert scavenging, and he'd find old abandoned miner shacks and bring back all the wood. He built our couch out of this stuff. He did the paneling. My parents were always building, tearing down and building and creating, and a lot of recycled stuff. So I live in this old town, and I'd see all these old doors and windows getting ready to get burned up on a wood pile or up against a garage. So I started collecting this stuff years ago, and I didn't want to be a hoarder, so I turned it into art. And like a panel door, I cut the panels with my skill saw, and then I've got like 5 pieces, you know, that I do a Venetian plaster that I do my artwork on the center, and the outside is the frame. And now I'm doing a glass painting. I've been doing some painting on glass and etching. So now I'm incorporating that into my classes as well.
We are speaking with Jackie Naiman-Jones here in Falls City. Jackie is known as Debbie from Manos, The Hands of Fate, and that film was shot in 1966. But beloved, all these years later, and available on DVD, and we are just visiting with Jackie as she talks about what she's up to these days. And you had mentioned earlier that your father had by chance tuned into the television and saw Manos, The Hands of Fate, which at the time had been a long-lost film, and he by chance happened to tune in and saw the film on Mystery Science Theater, which he excitedly called you to tell you about that. Did he live to see the film make a comeback and kind of become known in a different light than it had in the beginning?
Oh, absolutely. It's like I got invited to a lot of conventions and, you know, as a guest and interviewed a lot. And I always said, you know, that I felt like I was channeling him, you know, I always tell him how it went. And I'd always let people know that the master approved, you know, because he did. He got so much joy out of it. And
so he did know that people loved it in this kind of new generation, as it were.
Oh, yeah. And the reason he was watching the show that day was because he was a Mystery Science Theater fan. So
was he kind of an eccentric man?
Oh, yeah. He was unusual. He was a really sweet guy, but very artistic and open-minded and just a very sweet, gentle guy. I mean, his artwork when I was a child was a lot of nudes. I have a lot of his artwork, but they're huge. They're like 5 by 6 foot. They're huge paintings that I have no space to hang, but I have
them. Maybe sell them on eBay. They might be a collector's item, considering that the master himself.
I'm considering that. I just have no idea how to value them right now. But anyway, most of his work was nudes. And I already said where we lived. And in the 60s, right on the border of Mexico was a very strong Catholicism. And
you mean they weren't open-minded to his art?
Yeah. So, like, the kids that were my friends or that pretended to be or whatever, I think they would befriend me so they could get inside our house just to see what the hell was in there. We were like really awed to people around us, and I understand that.
Was your family religious?
You'll enjoy this. My parents went to Texas Christian University. I was born in Fort Worth, Texas in 1959. They met at TCU, and my dad was a ministry student. He became a minister. So when I was, up until I was 3 years old, he was the minister for the local First Christian Church congregation.
Were they a strict denomination, or what were they like?
No. First Christian Church, they're pretty open-minded. But still, you know, it's Christianity. He was a Christian. There was a family story about my dad being at the pulpit, having the Bible open, and I'm there with my mom. And what was I, like 3 years old, and I started screaming, "That's my Bible!" Yeah, she had to take me out.
So was your dad a preacher at the time of the shooting of the film?
No, he had a... The story that he had told me, that he was overseeing a funeral once, and I think it was a funeral. I can't remember now, but there was an incident. There was something that happened that just kind of rocked his world and shattered things. It just opened his mind to a new way of thinking, and he just felt he couldn't follow that particular path. It didn't make him less believing in a higher being or God, but not, he just couldn't go with a strict, you know, or with, you know.
And he had that revelation before Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Yeah, about three years probably before that.
Mm-hmm. Would you say he maybe identified as religious around the time that that film was made?
No, my dad was a very deep person, and I'll tell you, he was suicidal for most of my childhood. That's what I grew up with, was a deeply depressed, troubled human. And so, I don't know, like I said, when I told you earlier, he always played lead roles, so in theatrical productions. And one of the best roles that I remember him playing was when he did R.P. McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And that was, that was definitely a role he could relate to.
And Jack Nicholson played that in the film version?
Yes, in the film version, yeah. Yeah, but he played Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha.
I could see him playing that.
Yeah, he was good. He played King Arthur in Camelot. He sang, you know? I mean, it was a musical.
Did he have an operatic singing voice?
No, but I remember him doing quite well. I don't know as a kid, but he won Best Actor of the Year award 3 times during his time in community theater. So, and that's what I like to stress to people about Manos. Yeah, there's so many flaws in it, but you know, I think that's one of the things that draws people in. They recognize there's things in there that there's so much potential in different ways. It just comes together so surrealistically. It's so odd, you know, that it's hard to figure out. I mean, I've been talking to people about it all these years, and I'm still getting new revelations about it.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away. But the child, I'm not sure the master would approve. Or the dog. The master doesn't like children.
We only want to know where Valley Lodge is.
Which way do we go?
There is no place like that around here.
Do you know Manos is taught in film school as everything not to do in filmmaking? And for good reason. And I was at this event a few weeks ago, and I was talking to a woman. I was promoting my online classes, and she was selling some stuff at the local Grange Hall. And I said something about the film. And she said, oh, my son's a film student in L.A. I said, I wonder if he's heard of it. So she called him up, and he's like, oh, my God, yeah, they taught that in our class. And she told him who she was sitting with. He flipped out.
Starstruck.
He was. It was funny.
Sometimes those small world moments do make the world seem a little bit more beautiful.
Well, and I'll tell you, one of my high points in this whole thing, too, is I was a guest at Crypticon Seattle a few years ago, and Cassandra Peterson, Elvira, was a guest as well. And she was way on the other side of the room, and she always had a long line of people waiting for her autograph. And I kept thinking about going over and saying hi to her, because she did Manos on her show once. And I wanted to say hi, so I had a break, and I kind of meandered over there, and I saw this, like, scoped it all out. There's a long line of people, and there's this really buff woman sitting next to her. It looked like a bodyguard, so I had to figure it out, you know? So I got my moment, and I ditched around the side of the table, and I tapped her on the shoulder, and I'm like, hey, Cassandra. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this buff blonde woman, like, coming out of her chair like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know? I'm like, uh-oh. And I said to her real quick, I'm Debbie. I was in Manos. My dad was the master, you know, as quick as I could. And she looks at me, and all of a sudden her eyes got real big. And she throws her arm out real dramatically towards the line. And she goes, stop the line. And then she pulls me to my feet and just starts buffeting me with questions about Manos. And then we got a couple pictures together, and that was really, really awesome.
Have you had any other fan moments that were maybe bizarre, otherwise just from left field and unexpected?
Gosh, I'm sure. I'm sure. I remember being at an event, and this young woman was standing way back, and she was looking at the sign over my head, you know, my banner with me as six-year-old Debbie, and looking at me and looking back up and looking at me. And she's standing there, and my boyfriend at the time, he was such a great help. He would watch for people and make sure to bring people in that were holding back. And he went over there, and he's like, well, do you want to talk to her? You know, she'll... And that poor girl, she just like burst into tears. And I'm like, no, honey, it's okay. Oh, my God. I don't mean to make you cry.
She was just that excited to meet you?
Yeah.
When was this?
Oh, that was probably like 2016, 17, something like that. You know, what I've seen over the years is like when that guy from HBO sent me that VHS and it came in the mail, I took it into the bedroom and I watched it by myself and I just took a deep breath. I was just happy. I'm like, I got what I wanted. That's all I wanted. And then the next thing you knew, it was, it won fan favorite for the Turkey Day Awards for MST, like the following year.
Oh, Mystery Science Theater. Okay.
Yeah. And it won like at least three different times over the years, but it became a fan favorite. And I've been able to meet, you know, Joel Hodgson and Frank and Trace. And I wrote my book, Growing Up with Manos, The Hands of Fate, How I Was the Child Star of the Worst Movie Ever Made and Lived to Tell the Story. And I'm proud to say it's 4.5 stars on Amazon. Not bad. And Joel Hodgson wrote the foreword for me.
Who is Joel Hodgson again?
With the robots. He's the one that gets shot into space on MST. He's the host, the original host of
Mystery Science Theater. Okay. We're visiting with Jackie Naiman-Jones, who was Debbie, the child in Manos, The Hands of Fate, the classic film from 1966 that has been turned into 4 stage productions. There's been video games based on this concept, also trading cards, and some offshoot films such as Manos Returns and Hotel Torgo and Hands of Felt.
Yeah, Manos to Hands of Felt is puppet theater, and you can see that on YouTube. You can see the full, it's hilarious, it's wonderful. And then there was a stage production in Portland a few years ago, and it was funny because, you know, in the original movie, of course, it was all dubbed, and they had created a Doberman made out of cardboard and felt on little tiny wheels that they rolled across the stage, and it was so funny because it'd fall over every now and again. But Debbie, my character, was played by a doll that they carried around, and I found out about the play before it was released, you know, while they were still in rehearsal, and I contacted them, and they were pretty excited because I live just 1.5 hours from Portland. And so they invited me to be part of it, and I got to go, and I stayed in a bed and breakfast in Portland for the 2-week run of the show. But, you know, in the original film, my voice was dubbed by a middle-aged woman. And so I got to be in the sound booth and got to be my own voice as a middle-aged woman. I got to be the puppet's voice.
Did you put on a childish voice?
Yes. Oh, sorry.
Her dog's getting excited.
My dog. My dog, Shanka, yeah.
Named after the Doberman from Manos, The Hands of Fate, though this is a much smaller version. And what breed of dog is this?
She's a Chiweenie. She's a Chihuahua Dachshund mix. She's 7 pounds, and she's 8 months old.
Does she carry on the legacy of Shanka well?
Oh, yeah, gosh. She's in control of the wild turkeys that come through our yard, and she's actually made several young buck deer like walk away looking over their shoulders. So she's in charge of everything.
Does the master approve?
Oh, he certainly would. I know he would.
Very good. Well, Jackie Naaman Jones, thank you so much for your time and visiting with us this afternoon here in Falls City, where you live.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming out, and it's been a great time visiting with you.
Indeed it has. This is Dan Kroll. You're listening to KORC. And if you have not seen Manos, The Hands of Fate, I would highly recommend it. Of course, you can get the DVD. There is a version on YouTube, which I saw. It is not the same. It something about the aesthetic is very much lost in the remastered version, as Jackie seems to be agreeing with me on.
Yeah, I mean, there are several versions. And
which version should people seek out?
Oh, man, I wish I'd... I would say, you know, the restored version is so interesting because it's so clean. You can see the mistakes so much more clearly.
The mistakes are part of what makes it the film that it is,
and
by the way.
There's some intentional mistakes in there, you know, in the crew. Bernie Rosenblum and Bob Guidry were best friends and poker buddies and pranksters. So there's a scene with my dad holding his arms out in the house, and you'll see right below him is a beer bottle that they planted there intentionally to see if Hal Warren was paying attention, which it's in the film. And, well, there's several things like that that they did intentionally. You know, not all is a mistake, although most of it was, yeah.
Thanks again for taking the time to hang out with us.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Jackie Naaman Jones, who played the part of Debbie in Manos, The Hands of Fate. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayer with your Corvallis City Meetings for the week of February 19th, 2024. On Tuesday, February 27th at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board CAB meeting will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, February 28th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. On Thursday, February 28th at 1 p.m., there will be a Business Reliance Workshop held in person at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. Find out what types of incidents business owners need to prepare for and how local government coordinates response and recovery efforts during and after a disaster. On Friday, March 1st at 4 p.m., the City Legislative Committee will be meeting online only. Since the link to join the meeting is long and difficult to say on air, we've abbreviated it to clc.korcfm.com. And finally, on Saturday, March 1st at 10 a.m. to noon, Corvallis City Councilor for Ward 5, Charlene Ellis, will be holding Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library. Feel free to stop by and say hello and ask questions about local government. 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue here in Corvallis. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sarah.